Morning, Your Honors. Mr. Caraggia, may it please the Court. My name is Joni Ray Wimmer, and I'm here on behalf of Ron Reher. And I think this case explores the constitutionality of arresting someone for taking pictures at a public park with a video camera. The defendants are Lombard police officers that attempt to justify the arrest under the Illinois Disorderly Conduct Statute. And the plaintiff's position is pretty simple and straightforward, and that is that the case law and the statute itself, 26-1A1, make it clear that in order to be guilty of disorderly conduct under Illinois law, a person must do something unreasonable.
You know, I just want to say that this case is troubling too, like five out of the last six. But doesn't it seem reasonable to assume that if the officers hadn't taken any action, that it was possible that the mob of angry parents might have taken matters into their own hands and violence may have erupted? And weren't they entitled to take action to make sure that something like that didn't happen here?
Well, I think if someone is essentially the victim of an angry mob of people, I think it's the job of the police to put into check the angry mob of people unless the person who's the victim of the mob has done something wrong. And I mean, in this case, Ms. Outlaw, Mr. Reher's former significant other, had taken his camera out of his hand and thrown it on the sidewalk twice and broken it, and some people had tried to steal Mr. Reher's bike. The police could have addressed that conduct and the threats rather than arresting someone who had done nothing more than go to the park, supposedly, and take video pictures, although he hadn't even done that, but we have to assume, I understand, that he had because the police had been told that he had. It's our position that on May 7th, Mr. Reher didn't do anything that could be considered unreasonable by anybody. And so the defendant police officer should have known better than to arrest him. What were the police told? That he had been videotaping people, including children, in the park. That's all they were told. And there is evidence from which the jury could infer that that's all they were told. They weren't told that he did something suspicious with the video camera, like the person in Judge Hibbler's case that was cited by the defendants, where the plaintiff was sitting in a parking lot of a Target after dark, zooming in on women's breasts that were exiting the Target store. The police were not told that he had done anything suspicious with the camera. They weren't told that he was holding it under someone's skirt. All they were told is he was sitting in a park videotaping people.
Could you address Sergeant Kabinski's awareness of the history of conflict between Mr. Reher and Ms. Outlaw, the protective orders, and the fact that of all the parks in the Chicago metropolitan area, he happened to have ridden his bike to the one right outside her and his daughter's home?
I will, Judge. There was an incident 10 years previously where she claimed that Mr. Reher had thrown a rock through her window, and there was an incident 6 or 7 years before in which he distributed pictures of her, nude pictures of her, in the courtyard. And there was a battery case 9 years earlier. I mean, you know, I don't think that something that happened 6 or 7 years before can make his conduct unreasonable. He's allowed to go to a public park, and he's allowed to take pictures in it. If he had done something unreasonable on this occasion, and he didn't forfeit his rights to go to a public park and take pictures, because years before there had been criminal allegations between him and his former significant other. The other thing, and I think this is important, you can't, or one cannot, cite materials that are in the depositions if they're not set forth in the numbered paragraphs of the party's local 56.1 statement of material facts. And I reviewed the defendant's local 56.1 statement of material facts, and the only reference, I think, to protective orders was in their paragraph 65, where they said she knew the history of protective orders against the plaintiff by Ms. Outlaw, but there was no statement in there as to when they were entered, no statement as to what they were for.
Is there a citation to the depositions or affidavits?
There is a citation, but I believe all she said was that she knew the history of protective orders. There was no testimony in the paragraph or, I believe, in the deposition transcript as to what those orders were for. I mean, they say in their brief that it was for doing the same thing he was doing here, but there's absolutely no evidence of that in the numbered paragraphs of their local 56.1 submission. And it's not incumbent upon me to contradict things that are in the evidentiary materials attached to their local 56.1 statement if they're not set forth in the paragraphs. My job when I get a motion is to dispute, if I can, the materials set forth in the numbered paragraphs, not everything else that they haven't brought to the court's attention that might be in the evidentiary materials.
Now, Warren also told the officers that she had seen him in the park several times before, and Outlaw complained to the officers that he was videotaping Ashley. Couldn't the officers reasonably have thought that Rear was harassing Outlaw and Ashley based just on those two facts?
I don't think so, because she told the officer, I had seen him in the park a couple of times before. She didn't say when. They say in their briefs that she told the officer she saw him twice in 2007. That wasn't her testimony, and I corrected that in my response. All she said, I'd seen him in the park twice before. I thought he might be a pervert. But there was no basis to believe that he was a pervert. I'm going to reserve my time for rebuttal on this.
Thank you. Introduce yourself.
Good morning. My name is Jacob Karaja. I'm here representing the defendant officers, Sergeant Marilyn Gabinski and Frank Vivo.
You pronounce it Karaja?
Karaja, yes, Your Honor.
Even though it's a C?
Yes, it's a Turkish name.
Interesting. It's great. All right. Rare's reply lists several places where it appears that the government has used its version of the facts rather than the facts taken in the light most favorable to Rarer. And it seems as though he's correct on this. Do you have a response?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd answer that in two ways. First of all, Mr. Reher has not challenged the court's determination of the facts as not being present in the record. And this is before this court on a termination of summary judgment. He is taking issue with our characterization of several things, but not once has he made an argument to this court that Judge Conlon considered improper facts or considered facts in a light not most favorable to him. And that's really the issue before this court. And as this court is also aware, it's allowed to affirm the judgment of the trial court on any basis present in the record, whether or not it was argued at the time. And in answer to the general theme of Mr. Reher, as argued by his counsel just now, this case can be summarized best not only by the videotaping, but by a question that was answered by Sergeant Marilyn Gabinski in her own deposition by counsel present here today. She was asked, question, and what about going to the park to drink some water and see your daughter is unreasonable in your view? Her answer was, the fact that there was a previous history between he and Ms. Outlaw of domestic violence, the proximity of the park to her back door, the fact that he had binoculars and a video camera, and the fact that she's had previous orders of protection against Mr. Reher, the fact that this is not the first time he has shown up in the vicinity of her apartment building, and the fact that she's expressed concern that he keeps her under surveillance and that he might do harm to her. This is the main thrust of why the arrest happened, not this red herring of a videotaping. We do submit that the videotaping did have unusual suspicious circumstances that were just expressed by Sergeant Gubinsky in her testimony. And that's the unusual circumstance here, Your Honor. And that's why there was that's why there were probable cause here.
You look, the problem with the Illinois law in this case, which I realize is not being challenged, is that it smacks of the heckler's veto. I mean, suppose two men are in a park holding hands, and it's in a very conservative religious background, and the parents in the park are incensed. They're livid, they're threatened, God only knows what they are. The parents start screaming. They grab the men's bikes so they can't get away. There's a verbal altercation. Can the men be arrested for disorderly conduct?
Your Honor, I would answer that by quoting the language in the statute itself for disorderly conduct, and it isn't as counsel for Mr. Rieher has suggested. What the requirement is not that a conduct be unreasonable, but that the conduct be done is any act in such an unreasonable manner as to alarm or disturb another.
That's even worse.
That's what the Illinois General Assembly has said, and that's what has been upheld time and time again by not only this court, but Illinois Supreme Court, Illinois appellate courts.
So under my scenario, it would be unreasonable for the two men to hold hands in a religiously conservative playground that's surrounded by kids.
Perhaps, Your Honor. Perhaps it would be. It depends on the other circumstances. I can't answer that. What I can answer is that this court in Pertell versus Mason in 2008, affirming a 2006 judgment of Judge St. Eve, she's quoting, as the Seventh Circuit explains, quote, the emphasis of the statute is upon the tendency of the conduct to disturb others and to provoke disruptions of public order upon the unreasonableness of the activity when viewed in the context of the surrounding circumstances.
Now, you listed all the things that Gubinsky knew, but in terms of knowledge for Vivo, that information was not given to him, right?
There is question in the record whether or not he knew the full extent at the time of the arrest, and that goes to our argument about collective knowledge at the scene. They were standing there right together, both Gubinsky, Vivo, Mr. Rieher, and at different times Ms. Outlaw was out telling them different things. Ms. Lawrence was out telling them different things. But they were in close communication at this time. And I would suggest, Your Honor, that this is something that policy would suggest is a good idea. If we're saying that he doesn't have...
Judge Conlon found that the collective knowledge doctrine did not apply.
That is correct, and that is an issue that we challenged in our brief as being held incorrectly as an alternative basis to uphold the grant of summary judgment. However, it would be absurd to say Officer Vivo, if he indeed were the only one that was arresting, and that's not clear in the record, but if indeed he was, and if indeed he didn't have all the information, he soon found that out later. So then this court is looking at, well, he didn't have probable cause at 7 o'clock p.m., but at 7.05 p.m. after he was in custody, he learned about all the issues that were probable cause. I want to close by saying that we also made our qualified immunity argument that even if this court were to find that there isn't probable cause, there is qualified immunity here, and this is because these officers at the scene cannot be held to be judges. And I want to submit to this court that...
I don't know what I would have done. Yeah.
Exactly,
no,
Your Honor.
No, I didn't say that.
It's hard to sit in judgment of what these officers are that aren't held to be legal experts according to the case law. However, the record is clear that Ms. Outlaw went to the DuPage County Court that same day, filled out an affidavit of the same things that she told the officer, and the judge in that case made a specific finding that, quote, the conduct or actions of Rieher, unless prohibited, will likely cause irreparable harm or continued abuse. And it would be surpassing strange for this court to hold, well, it's okay for that judge to make that finding based upon Ms. Outlaw's representations of potential future harm to Ms. Outlaw, but it's not okay for the officers actually at the scene to believe Ms. Outlaw, who told them the same things, and arrest for this future imminent harm to either her or other people at the scene.
Do we have that in our record?
Yes, Your Honor. It is in the record. It's the affidavit is cited in Exhibit 6 to our summary judgment motion by Zelda Outlaw, and the order itself is not in the summary judgment. It's in the motion to dismiss. It's attached as an exhibit to our motion to dismiss. And not only that, there has been an expert that's looked at this ex post facto, and Judge Conlon, who is a federal judge sitting on the bench for many years, when presented with the same facts, which are not being challenged here, she has found that there was probable cause. And even if, with all respect, all three of you disagree, I submit that that's evidence that a reasonable mind, that is a legal scholar, could think there's probable cause, which would extend the qualified immunity, that these officers cannot be held to a higher standard than a federal judge.
Can I ask you something totally why isn't the Corporation Council here? Why are you here?
We are the Corporation Council, Your Honor. This is the Village of Lombard. We're the council for the village.
Oh, you are?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Hi.
Good morning. Still good morning.
All right.
I would just like to close by saying that that unless the court has any further questions, that we're going to rest on our briefs at this point. I'm glad I was able to have the opportunity to make these points clear. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Ms. Wimmer, how much time? Okay, we'll give her 3.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll talk fast. First of all, it's not in the record that Ms. Outlaw told the same things that are in her affidavit to the police. If that had been in one of the numbered paragraphs of their local 56.1 statement, I would have disputed it because I asked the officers, what were you told by Ms. Outlaw? And why did you arrest Mr. Reher? And there's things in her affidavit that they didn't tell me about. So the jury could infer that Ms. Outlaw didn't tell the officers everything she told the judge later on. As far as the surveillance, I asked, you have a lot of code words. Well, you know, she had been afraid she was under surveillance. And when Ms. Gabinski told me that, I said, well, let's get down to it. Tell me what is it. Tell me specifics. And all she could come up with was an incident 10 years previously where Outlaw claimed that Rear had thrown a rock through her window and was across the street watching her apartment, and an incident 6 or 7 years before when he distributed pictures of her in the courtyard, although on that occasion she didn't say that Outlaw had told her Rear was keeping her under surveillance. So there's no big history of Mr. Reher stalking or surveilling this woman, according to Gabinski herself. But the other thing I want to tell you is, as far as the collective knowledge doctrine, Mr. Vivo testified that he was told something about the relationship between Mr. Reher and Ms. Outlaw after Mr. Reher had been arrested, and he, Officer Vivo, was escorting Reher to the car. That's my response of paragraph to defendant's paragraph 54, and I cite Officer Vivo's testimony. As far as they say it's not an element of the crime of disorderly conduct that someone do something unreasonable, this court's decision in Biddle versus Martin said 3 elements are required. The defendant's conduct must be A, be unreasonable, B, disturb and alarm another, and C, threaten to provoke. As far as qualified immunity, I cited the Green case and the Hope case, which say you don't need a case whose facts are materially similar to this case as long as the case law put the officers on reasonable notice that they were treating the plaintiff in an unconstitutional way.
What about the argument that, look, Judge Conlon found probable cause here? Why can't a police officer, for purposes of qualified immunity, at least rely on that?
Well, I think that rule would say that that you can never win an appeal from a false arrest case, because they'll say, well, if the trial judge...
It depends on the basis. But if the issue is from undisputed facts drawing an inference of probable cause, then it would make it tough, sure.
Well, I think that's why we have courts of appeal. I mean, I think that her statement that someone could deem conduct sitting on a park bench, videotaping people to be unreasonable. It's just not valid. And we've also cited the Cooper case that said, that was decided before this, where they said videotaping in and of in public in and of itself is not disorderly conduct. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is going to be taken under advisement. I want to thank both of you. What a well-argued case. Really. Thank you very much.